We are back on the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Seems like we haven't done a quote-unquote normal episode in a while. We've been doing all this trade deadline stuff, culminating in our two-part mock trade deadline extravaganza with me, Danny, Kevin Pelton from ESPN, and Dan Feldman from NBC. If you haven't listened to that yet, stop right now and go listen to those. Those are way better than this show, although this show should still be pretty good. But we put a ton of work into that. As far as I know, no one else has ever done anything like it, and we've been getting some very nice reviews on that. So definitely go listen to that first. But today, we just got to catch up, Danny. It's really been quite a while since we've just gotten to some of the recent goings on in the league, and there are quite a few of those.
There are, and I think one of the biggest stories right now as we're heading close to the All-Star break is that, in my opinion, both leagues are headed towards a kind of nine-team playoff race.
Yeah, it's really starting to look that way. In the West, you've got the Grizz, and we'll get to some of the injury news with all these teams as well, obviously. The Grizz at fifth, but having just lost Marc Gasol. The Mavs, Jazz, Blazers, and Houston. That's five teams basically fighting for the final four spots. And it looks like all those teams really, I think, maybe Houston, you might say, is a little bit behind those. But with Memphis not having Gasol anymore, Utah and the Blazers playing really well, the Mavs kind of stagnating, going back to the pack. I think Houston is looking the worst of those teams right now, but they probably have close to the most talent. I think it's a pretty solid five-way race there for those final four spots.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to talk about the game tonight, but I watched the first quarter of the Kings-Sixers game and, you know, bits and pieces throughout. And when I watched them, even though they did end up winning the game, I didn't see a team that can rise enough to beat two of those five teams.
I agree with you, and they're also, I think, like five games behind now.
Right.
So that's a pretty major issue as well. I think even more so, even if they just could get back to playing, I mean, at their best this year, even with Cousins in the lineup, they've really only been playing 500 ball. And that now is not getting it done. It looks like that with the Jazz and Blazers really now kind of on fire lately, it looks like you're going to have to get to 500. And some of those teams, especially the Jazz, now that they're healthy, you have to think that, you know, they're not going to keep winning, you know, have a bunch of seven-game win streaks, but you have to think that, you know, at least 500 balls, slightly above that, is what they're going to be able to play for the rest of the season. Let's get to the East. Also, a nine-team race by the two projection systems I like to consult. That's ESPN's BPI and then 538, which our buddy Neil Payne, who used to work for the Hawks, had a good bit to say in those projection systems. 538 still gives the Wizards 28%. BPI gives them, you know, something like 10% or something like that. And so really, if you're not going to count in the Wizards, then you're looking at sort of, I think, a three-team race for the final two spots.
Yeah, and of course, the injuries are going to factor in there. But so would you say those teams are Chicago, Charlotte, and Detroit?
Yeah, I think I would. You know, the Bulls now are 27-25. They've lost like 13-18 or something really bad like that. Detroit lost today, but had a bunch of guys out. KCP has been out, and Reggie Jackson had an illness today, and I can't remember who else did too, but they definitely did not have their full squad. And then Charlotte, who had been playing great, now with this MKG news, they are going to be in a little bit of a dogfight. I think actually Charlotte is probably the best of those teams, maybe even without MKG, as long as they can stay healthy. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking at. I think that Miami, the Hawks, those two teams, Boston, obviously, I think those teams are looking relatively safe at this point.
And also, when you look at it with nine teams and maybe the Wizards as the plus one, is that it would take a lot to, you know, you have enough space for them to fall out. When it's an eight-team race, then a team getting hurt, and you know what happened, maybe what could happen to Memphis is there. But when it's nine, then you already have the team to fill the gap.
Yeah, and Indiana is that other team that, despite their loss to Charlotte today, I mean, maybe they have a little bit of a head start record-wise on those teams. So I would say that I'm thinking they're probably in a little bit better position than those bottom three teams are. So let's get to the news here now. What do we got first?
You want to start with the firing?
Yeah, Derek Fisher was fired. There had been some rumblings that he might be on a little bit of thin ice. Obviously, the Matt Barnes incident in the preseason was not particularly conducive to his tenure, and the Knicks had lost 9 out of 10. I would say, though, that I think that they had, even with that rough losing streak, had been exceeding what anyone's reasonable expectations would have been for them this year. Wouldn't you agree?
I would, and Ian Levy wrote a nice piece for the Sporting News talking about them relative to expectations, and we talked earlier in the season about how they looked like they were playing much better defensively than we expected, and that did erode somewhat over the course of the year like we expected, but they still, I think they were 19th or 20th. That's better than I expected with their constituent talent. And, you know, they played reasonably hard, and there are long-term things. Like, I didn't think that a lot of what they were doing was really catered around Porzingis' special skill set, but he's a rookie, and you don't always expect that, you know, in the first couple months of the season for a guy like that. And the big question that I have with it is, where do they go next? Because coaching always matters, but when you're in a big market that is trying to get free agents, it takes on a different level of importance.
Yeah, I think that's right. You make a great point there, and there are some nebulous reports that having fired Derek Fisher wouldn't go over well for their potential pursuit of Kevin Durant. Dan Feldman made a good point that those odds are so low that you got to just do what you're going to do. You can't keep Fisher around just for, you know, that 5% chance that he comes, if it's even that high. But I think the more interesting thing, Phil, in his press conference afterwards, said essentially that he wants someone that he has a relationship with. He's still very high on the triangle. There are some reports that Fisher going away from the triangle too much was part of why he got fired. They also supposedly did not see growth in him as a coach. Phil said that he wasn't using the assistant coaches that they had provided, Jim Clemens and Kurt Rambis, as guys who were maybe triangle experts. I happen to think that they have a player in Kristaps Porzingis who is absolutely made for running high pick and roll all the time, you know, in the Dirk Nowitzki style. But I think that Phil also needs to maybe consider going outside of his preferred cronies to just get the best available coach, especially if they strike out on Luke Walton. I don't think that there's anyone else who has any kind of a resume that you could reasonably think is going to work out there. And there's also rumblings that Phil could leave after next year. He supposedly can opt out of his contract. I don't know why he'd do that if he's getting paid $12 million a year. But nonetheless, unless it were to go to the Lakers, that's sort of what the like very random scuttlebutt is. But anyway, that's all in the future. Kurt Rambis is the interim coach. He's going to get a chance to kind of prove himself. It sounds like there is some chance that he could win the job if they do well. They start off with a loss, though, so that may not happen. Anything else on that before we move on?
Just that the triangle Phil Jackson coaching tree is a little bit scary when you think about, you know, Brian Shaw didn't have the most illustrious tenure at his last job. Rambis, if you ever want to get a Minnesota sports writer going, just talk about the Kurt Rambis tenure with the Wolves. And so you think about those as kind of being the two big options other than Luke Walton, and Walton is going to have a lot of options. And you think about all of the structural things that are potential problems in New York. I'm not sure that's a job that he would be chomping at the bit, especially as a West Coast guy.
Well, and why would he want to run the triangle? And why would any coach want to come in and have your offensive system prescribed for you? You're coming in, you don't know what the personnel is. You're not going to be able to adjust it all on the fly if your personnel just doesn't fit the triangle, which I think, you know, not a ton of personnel around the league really does at this point. So if that's really what the mandate is going to be, especially for someone taking your first coaching job, you're a big superstar. Also, you're a West Coast guy, as Luke is. There's talk that he could go to the Lakers. I would much rather go to the Lakers than the Knicks, I think, at this point, even though they do have Porzingis, who's probably better than anyone in the Lakers pipeline. All right, let's a couple other things. The Nets are, as we joked about on the Mock Trade Deadline podcast, they are getting close to choosing a GM. Supposedly, there are about six candidates that have been bandied about. We'll see who, some of them decent, some of them less so. We'll see who ends up getting it. But the bigger thing, probably I think the biggest story, maybe even bigger than Fisher being fired, is this Marc Gasol injury.
I think it's substantially bigger than Fisher because there was always a possibility of that. But Gasol changes the Western Conference. And so it is not definite. I think I was reading Jeff Stotts the last couple of days, and he was talking about how it's a little bit frustrating as his knowledge as an injury guy that we don't know exactly what the injury is. But it's the reports, I think it's a midfoot fracture. And then beyond that, there are some reports out there, but I haven't seen anything truly definitive.
Yeah, Woj reported that there could be surgery to insert a pin that would have him out until the summer. They are supposedly still evaluating that, but there is really no chance that he would be back before April, according to Woj, and that even still getting him back into things. I mean, Memphis probably wasn't going to win a first-round playoff series anyway. They're still going to try to make the playoffs. They may try to make some moves. Even Woj reported that they might try and pitch Kevin Durant, which, I mean, why not? You might as well ask for a meeting. Doubt they get it. But, I mean, I see no reason why Durant would ever want to go to Memphis instead of Oklahoma City. Much better chance to win in Oklahoma City than Memphis. But, you know, whatever, give it a shot. And so, I don't know. I think if I were them, and it looks like Mark were kind of not going to come back this year, I would try to go into sell mode. But it's easy to say that when you also now have this Hobson's choice of we're going to either re-sign Mike Conley to a giant five-year contract that's going to be a terrible contract by the time it's over, or we're going to lose him. And that's not what Marc Gasol signed up for another 5 years either when they maxed him out last year. This just makes all of their issues much harder than it was, because you could at least hope maybe they would get a first-round win against the Clippers or somebody and, you know, grind into a somewhat competitive loss like they did with the Warriors and sort of convince everybody that things are still going okay. And now it's going to be much, much harder to do that.
You touched on the Conley part of it, which I think is really important. And a smaller aspect, but still from a team-building perspective, is that they had that double-sided protection on the pick that they originally sent to Cleveland that is now to Denver because of the Mozgov trade. So basically, if they miss the playoffs but finish outside the top five picks, they lose that pick and it goes to Denver. And so, well, that's not going to be the end-all be-all for the Grizzlies. That would have been a nice team-building piece. So it's another incentive, not only an incentive to make the playoffs, but it's another thing to think about with where this team is going.
Yeah, that's another issue as well. And I think just in a vacuum, I would say I'm going to trade Mike Conley right now. I am, you know, I might even try and trade Zach Randolph, and we're going to totally rebuild here because this team is not going to win a championship and probably can't even get to the second round in future years. But in reality, this is a team that is connected so much with the fan base. And this kind of struck me too, that for some of these smaller market teams, like you remember we looked at that list of the NBA's ratings and we looked at what some of the bottom five were, and some of those teams, you know, like the Pelicans have like 7,000 people a game watching their games. You know, the Magic are like 15,000. Like some of these teams, you know, that are the same size really as Memphis. And if you fall out of it, your TV ratings are going to be awful. And then you look at that, all right, you know, we only have 7,000 people watching per game on TV. Now your gate becomes way more important to your profitability as well. And a lot of these teams just cannot afford to be bad, maybe for a year, maybe for 2 years, but they just have to kind of get back to the playoffs financially, especially when you consider that the cap is going to be jumping so much, especially because of TV money, both national, which they get a piece of, but also the cap goes up every time a team like the Warriors or the Clippers, who I think are redoing their TV deal, or the Knicks are just kind of pegged to the Lakers. But, you know, every time a big market team redoes its TV deal, the cap is now going to shoot up. And as a smaller market, your media rights are not going up nearly as quickly as the big markets are. And so it's just hard from a business standpoint to be bad for long enough to build a very consistent contender. That's what we've seen in New Orleans, where there was this pressure to improve right away. And so I think at the very least, Memphis has to play out the string with all these guys. And, you know, if they just kind of burn out, then maybe you can sell off the pieces. But then you're kind of, you know, setting the clock back on the rebuild as well. But I think that they ultimately, and forgive me for going on so long, but they ultimately are pretty happy to just be making the playoffs every year, and they would never break that up.
One other small thing to add is that losing a point guard not only affects your watchability, but it affects your continuing relevance. While there are a lot of them in the league, being without one, as we're kind of seeing with the Nets, can be catastrophic. And so if you give up Mike Conley and don't really have a replacement, which they do not have, you know, they have Chalmers for this year, you're hurting yourself in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and there's no point guards at all available on the market. I think you make a great point there. Everyone always says, oh, hey, there's all these point guards. They're easily replaceable. Don't overpay. But yeah, the teams that don't have one, like, the Nets are just so bad. I think if they had a point guard, they could be totally respectable, you know, but they just don't. All right, that's probably enough on Gasol. We'll, I'm sure, have more once we find out what the issues are. And both, I think, because of the All-Star break and the trade deadline, it is in Memphis's interest to sort of just push back any announcements on what's going to happen to him until after play resumes. The trade deadline is a week from today, Thursday, so the 20th.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler, it has a knee sprain, guessing about 4 weeks. And again, that's a player who is so important to his team. The Bulls, of course, are dealing with other issues, injury issues as well. I think they're a little better suited to handle the absence, but it's problematic for them too.
I don't know if they are at this point. I think they're in worse shape than Memphis is without Gasol. Frankly, Butler's better than Gasol. Chicago, he was one of the two decent defensive players, really, who can do anything on offense on the team. Now they're basically down to Taj Gibson. Etuan Moore is okay at times. They're already missing Nikola Mirotic. They're basically, Bobby Portis is not ready from a defensive standpoint. Mirotic, who knows when he's going to be back? He had complications with that appendix surgery. He just got stitches out today, and he's lost 15 pounds, which he really can't afford either, frankly. Like, he's a pretty skinny guy already. You know, I would imagine it's going to be weeks before he's back. And also, that really kind of just makes things a little more difficult for Chicago at the trade deadline, too, because I think a lot of the decisions that you're going to make were based on, all right, is Mirotic really our power forward of the future? I think they felt very comfortable about that last summer. This year's events maybe have cast some doubt on that, especially as he's gotten a year older. He's been worse this year than he was last year, and now he's had this injury. So you have to really wonder about that. Do they need like a whole new front court now, or can they count on him? And then you can't really play him and Gasol together as your starting front court. You got to get someone who's better defensively. All of this for the Bulls, I mean, they're just in a total tailspin right now. If this doesn't right and Butler's going to be out for 4 weeks or so, I don't know if they can keep afloat. I mean, they could be 500 by the time he gets back at this point.
And you also have the problem with them, which is the optimism that if you got into the playoffs that you could make some noise. And while that is certainly a reasonable argument considering their talent, you know, like if they were at 100%, which for the Bulls seems so unlikely, that makes you want to keep it together when you think about the revenue that's involved and the prestige and everything like that. And so that...
Yeah, they're also going to be going into free agency as well. A good showing in the playoffs could help them with that.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, I think you and I are probably more supportive of trading Pau Gasol than they are, but this changes it a little bit, but I'm not sure it changes their discussion that much, especially considering we're not going to see this team as much without Jimmy Butler before the deadline just because there are no games for another week.
Yeah, you know, it's almost too bad in some respects. I mean, if this injury had to happen, you never want anybody to get injured. But it's kind of almost too bad that this injury didn't happen a month ago. And then they'd say, all right, you know, we're really kind of out of it. And they could proceed in that way. Now they're really kind of in this limbo. And, I mean, you look back at what they've done against some of the good teams that they've played when they've been fully healthy. They beat the Spurs at home. They beat Toronto. They've had some great wins this season, to be sure. But I think really it's starting to become clear now, and has been even over the past month, that once Noah went down, they just had no chance of defending well enough to really be up there with the big boys as a contender. I still always felt like the best version of them was with Noah and Mirotic, and, you know, at least getting Noah in there enough so that the second unit could be really good defensively, or at least even hold up defensively. And now once Taj Gibson goes out of the game, you've got McDermott, Bobby Portis. I mean, you're just not stopping anybody with those guys on the floor. So it's really this thing with Butler. He was still one of their best defensive players. It might be just time to kind of see what these young guys have. But even then, you know, Mirotic is still out. So it's a very difficult situation now for the Bulls. And I mean, with the way that they're playing, if Butler is really going to miss some time, they could be really the most likely team of those last three that we talked about to fall out unless somebody else experiences injuries.
There's a meaningful chance the Bulls, Knicks, and Lakers all miss the playoffs this year.
Yeah, the three highest revenue teams by far. And Butler, we would be remiss in not discussing. He, you know, it's been much publicized. He had this bet with his trainer where he's going to play all 82. Finally, he succumbed to knee tendonitis in the game before he got hurt. Came back, was playing very well. I think he had 18 points in the first half against the Nuggets. And then on a pretty innocuous drive to the basket, he just, you know, crumpled in a heap on his left knee. He just went to take off on his left foot, a 1 foot takeoff, and, you know, just kind of crumpled. You thought at first that it was going to be way worse. You didn't want to jump to conclusions because sometimes it's not, like with Damari Carroll last year. And this turned out to not be, you know, everything is supposedly intact. And we don't know. It's also, of course, because it's the Bulls, we don't know exactly what ligament it was that was sprained. I mean, a knee sprain, there are specific ligaments that get sprained. But, you know, he was coming off of this knee tendonitis. He'd been playing a ton of minutes recently, as he always has. You know, he hasn't really meaningfully had his minutes reduced hardly at all, despite the new Hoiberg regime. And then he was thrown back out there with tendonitis. I mean, just having had that, one thing that can happen when you have tendonitis is your muscle just doesn't want to fire. You know, you can't transfer the force to your knee as well. And so when you go to take off real hard, your knee can kind of buckle. And I think that could very well have been, we don't know for sure what happened there, but certainly it's very suspicious when a guy misses a game due to tendonitis in that knee and then injures that same knee on a non-contact innocuous play the very next game, and just another kind of black mark for this Bulls medical staff that really just, you know, always seems to have problems. And then they've got Taj Gibson now out with a foot strain. What does that mean? And he is now suffering this because of his ankle injury and the surgery that he had over the summer. And, you know, maybe he'll get healthy over the break, but they can't afford to lose him either. If he's out, I mean, they're probably going to be the worst defense in the league.
Do you want to tackle the shoulder trio at once, all at one time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was watching that Charlotte-Indiana game, which we'll get to in greater detail. This looked like a bad one as soon as it happened. This is Kid Gilchrist, that same right shoulder that he had a torn rotator cuff on. He was supposed to be out for the year, came back early. You know, he was wearing one of those shoulder stabilizing shirts. He tried to drive into traffic, lost the ball, just plays so hard, dove on the ground. And Miles Turner, I think, just kind of got knocked over or was kind of going for the ball, landed on his back as Kid Gilchrist was reaching out with his right arm, and it just kind of pushed his shoulder back in what looked, again, like pretty innocuous, but because it was injured, I mean, you could hear him yell on the broadcast, and I saw someone falling, and I was like, oh, that should be his shoulder. And it is reported as dislocated. We don't know anything more than that. It could be possible that he could maybe be out, you know, a matter of weeks instead of having to have another surgery. But I think it's not looking good, especially since he already injured that. The amount of pain that he looked like he was in, I think it's really a shame for them because they're playing so well since he had returned.
Yeah, that's exactly where I wanted to get to, is that they've played excellently since they got him back. And, you know, he's not a perfect player, but his energy and his defense and his rebounding, and his three-point shooting, I think, was a little bit better than it had been. So they've been doing well, and a little bit sunnier but still frustrating shoulder news. Kevin Love injured the same shoulder, the left shoulder, that he'd had problems with before, but fortunately it sounds like that's less severe. Chris Haynes tweeted out that the Cavs expect that his shoulder contusion, that he will be available for their first game back from the All-Star break, which is against Chicago, who we just talked about.
Yeah, it looked pretty bad. We were hearing, oh, he ran off the court holding his shoulder kind of limply, the same way he did when he hurt himself in that game 4 against Boston, but really glad to hear that he's okay. And his the guy who actually injured him in last year's playoff, Kelly Olynyk, also suffered what is being called a shoulder subluxation by the Celtics training staff. That is not as bad as a dislocation for reference. We'll wait for the professionals to really write it up. But for reference, like Joakim Noah, I think, had a subluxation initially, and then when he came back and had the dislocation. But that's, I think, what happened to Olynyk. So I think we're probably looking at, you know, a 3-4 week kind of thing initially, but I'm sure he'll have an MRI to determine whether there is any further damage. But subluxation is definitely better than dislocation, at least. But yeah, I mean, this has been the year of these horrible shoulder injuries.
It's disappointing, and all three of those guys are such important contributors to successful teams that, well, it sucks for anybody. It does hurt more, as you know, as a basketball fan, when you see players who are doing well and on important teams go down like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's been Kobe, it was K-Love last year, Noah this year, these guys that we're talking about. And I think also, just, you know, because the shoulder is kind of an unstable joint, it is something that is very, very easy to re-injure when you come back. I mean, I think the only guy, you know, AD is a guy who has thankfully avoided that. Myers Leonard had a shoulder issue as well. He's avoided any further injury, but it definitely is something that is, and you always kind of wondered with MKG, for example, coming back so much earlier, all right, is he really ready here or not? And, you know, the way that he had someone fall on him, that was kind of a freak thing. It's hard to say that he came back before he was ready. That could have happened to him if he came back next year. So I don't know, but that's definitely something to always kind of be aware of, that shoulders are things that are pretty easy to re-injure.
Are you ready for an awkward segue? Speaking of recurring injuries, Tyreek Evans.
Yeah, and this will now be his third knee surgery?
I think so.
In the last year. Whew. On that right knee. We knew there was trouble when he had the second one. Then he came back again in December, was describing himself in early January as having shooting pains in the knee. We said on the podcast, that's not good at all. And now he's decided to shut it down. Probably the right move for him as a guy who's going to be going into his free agent season next year. The Pelicans are out of it. They can at least, you know, if they were trying to trade him, that wouldn't work out too well. He really, I think, needs to get healthy. But it's at the point, unfortunately, now where if you're being smart as a GM, you're probably just going to assume that he's damaged goods until he proves otherwise and makes it through a season healthy.
He's going to have a really tough challenge next year to make it through because it's a prove-it year. He's a guy who has talent that everybody certainly likes. He won Rookie of the Year over Stephen Curry and numerous other talented players. And he'll have to show it, though, because even if you have fans, that's fine around the league in GM circles. But you're going to need to actually be on the court because otherwise, even with contracts rising, it's such a huge risk.
And speaking of terrible medical staffs, this is now Quincy Pondexter not going to play at all this year. He's having a second surgery. Tyreke Evans now on his third surgery. Whatever they are doing in New Orleans is not working from a medical perspective.
Yeah. I think we have one more injury, right?
Yeah, Festus Ezeli.
So he had knee surgery. He's going to be, the functional term here is he's going to be reevaluated in 6 weeks. So that doesn't necessarily mean he'll be back then. That means he'll be reevaluated then. And the problem, obviously, the Warriors are a team that is going to do fine in the 6 weeks without him just because they're so crazy good. And Spates is, you know, he looked a little less great tonight, but he's done a very good job in Azili's absence. It makes them in a dangerous spot relative to injury. But the Warriors are in a tough spot because it's hard for them to get better and deeper because of the way that the roster is constructed to compete this year.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think Spates is someone who can really be taken advantage of defensively. He's been hitting his shots a little bit more, even taking some threes, which if he starts doing that regularly, even hit a pick-and-pop three from Curry the other day, that makes him a lot more palatable. But he is definitely someone who can really be attacked in pick-and-roll, especially if teams are going to put their star back in at the start of the second and fourth quarters when he is in there. I think if I were Kerr in the playoffs, I would really look to spot him only at times when the other team's ball handling pick and roll guy is out of the game. And I think that's something that he did a little bit in last year's playoffs, kind of rejiggering the rotation a little bit. But anyway, I think that, yeah, they need somebody, a big who is not a total zero offensively and can defend a pick and roll a little bit better than Spates can, has a little bit more rim protection. But the problem is, A, as we noted in our mock trade deadline podcast, they don't have a ton of assets. I mean, I think they're kind of looking for that guy, and I don't think Jason Thompson is not it, but, by the way, in case anyone's wondering. At least so far, he hasn't picked up the system. He just does not have the coach's trust, really, despite the fact that he's been a good pro so far this year. But even also, if you look at the list of pending free agents among bigs, there isn't anybody who really fits the bill anyway.
Yeah, and they could be interesting for buyout candidates, but at the same time, you know, it's a temporary playing time thing, and they can't clear roster spots.
Well, and I mean, they could dump Ian Clark or somebody.
Yeah, that's true. I guess they could.
Or James Michael McAdoo hasn't played in a long time due to a toe injury. But I think the bigger issue is who gets bought out,
yeah,
pending free agent. And so if there are none of those guys to trade for, there's probably not really any of those guys to get bought out either. I mean, maybe someone like Nene, but I don't see why Washington would buy him out as long as they are still in it. And if the Warriors wanted to, say, trade for him, he's making $13 million. Because they're in the tax, they would have to take back 80%, or they'd have to send out 80% of his salary. And to do that, they would have to give up Spates and Jason Thompson. So now you're getting Nene, who's an upgrade, but then he could get injured at any time. And now you're really with no backup center at all if that happens. So and they would also have to take on more money and then also throw in an asset for Washington's benefit as well. And I don't think they really would want to part with a first rounder for that. So I think the chances of an upgrade are slim. If they can do it, I will be very impressed.
And Azili's a pending free agent. And this, of course, you know, he's missed a lot of time due to injury. This is something that will chill his market at least a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing for him. It's probably the biggest issue. I mean, because the way he was playing when he was healthy, he was like a starting center, you know, probably average to slightly below average starting center level of play. And that's a $15 million a year player probably in this market, accounting, although maybe a little bit less when you count for the chilling effect of being a restricted free agent, or maybe more because they're going to overpay to get him away from the Warriors. But in any event, now he will have missed big, big chunks of every season except for his rookie year, all due to knee problems and other lower body issues. And so, I mean, he might be a guy now who decides to take the qualifying offer next year. But on the other hand, he's a guy who could get hurt and then really, you know, one more knee issue. And we still don't know what it is. It's supposed to be something related to cartilage. And I think the 6 weeks would be optimistic, frankly, for him to be back. And it would probably be more like eight. And I think you're at the point where you can't really count on him being back and in great shape for the playoffs. Yeah, you know, it's really a shame for him personally as a guy who basically has made, you know, like $4 million in his career, a guy who could have had life-changing money. And this is another reason why, right, like you go for the extension if it's offered. It's not clear what that offer ever was, but maybe that's why you do that when you have life-changing money on the table.
Yep.
The Spurs, Tim Duncan had missed like 7 or 8 games with knee soreness. He actually was back, didn't play very much against the Magic today, did not close the game. We'll talk about that a little more. But Manu Ginobili, after being hit in the groin region, is out 4 to 6 weeks after testicular surgery. That's bad.
Yeah, it is. And he plays such a pivotal role for this team, you know, in terms of his creation on the second unit and just his ability to do so many different things for their offense. And to have him out, they don't really have a replacement, you know, that they don't have somebody like that. And to me, what that injury does is it settles them into the second seed and maybe makes the 2-3 more competitive than the 1-2.
Maybe. Although the silver lining here is that Jonathan Simmons can get into things a little bit more, earn more of Pop's trust. He's already been in the rotation, add some really needed athleticism for them. And then also, Danny Green now has finally been running into form these last few games after and hitting his threes. He was a guy who Pop, even, you know, when he's going well, would kind of yank him around and take him out of the game. And you remember in that Warriors game, he got taken out for Simmons like 2 minutes into the game when he missed a rotation. But now Pop is really going to have to play him. I think that'll really help his confidence, get him back on track, because they really need him to be draining threes in the playoffs. So maybe there is a silver lining, but the bad part is Manu was playing incredibly well, and you know, also it doesn't sound too pretty. So
one other small piece of Spurs news. Yeah. L'Équipe is reporting that Tony Parker will play for France in the Olympic basketball qualifier, which is positive for a lot of different reasons. And one of them is that because of the timing of it, which we talked about before, there are a lot of French players by circumstance that are free agents this year. He's one of the few guys that's under contract. So that is another consideration beyond the fact that he's an incredibly good basketball player.
Yeah, and they have a tough qualification road. They are in the same bracket as Canada and I think Italy as well, I want to say. So, and only the winner of their tournament actually makes it to the Olympics. I certainly will be rooting for France. I think that they, at this point, are pretty close to being able to give USA their best possible matchup. The only team that really can come close to matching up with the U.S. athletically. So I think that'll be, Tony playing will be great, even though, you know, he actually wasn't that good last year at Eurobasket. Before we move on to the games, I want to tell you about SeatGeek, the inaugural sponsor of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, and of course, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite sports team. SeatGeek knows the fair market value of every ticket, and so you can go on there, look at their deal score metric. Green is a good deal, red perhaps not so good, and they also aggregate together all of the ticket buying sites. So in the early days of buying tickets, you would have to go to a bunch of different sites. You'd feel all this angst like, oh, what if I'm not getting the best price? Now you don't have to worry about that anymore. It's all right there in an app that's free to download, very easy. And right now, my listeners can get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Go into the settings tab and enter the promo code CAPSPACE. Very easy to remember, CAPSPACE. We talk about it all the time on the program. And SeatGeek will send you your $20 once you've made your first ticket purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app and enter promo code CAPSPACE today. All right, let's get to the games. Actual NBA basketball that we are going to analyze. Quick notes on Warriors Phoenix. Didn't see a ton of this game, but you know, I saw maybe the whole second half or so ultimately. And really the most newsworthy event out of this was Markieff Morris continuing to melt down a bit after you know, a like 2-game long renaissance.
Yeah, he claimed after the game that it was, I guess, some form of tough love and that he's done things like that before. It didn't look good. And for Markieff Morris, when you're thinking about, you know, the way that he looks around the league, he's a guy who I think would like to be traded. That.
Yeah, yeah. He gave Archie Goodwin like a hard shove as they were going back to the basket. And they're supposedly great friends, but it's just a very ugly look. I can't recall seeing one player on another team physically, you know, I mean, Archie, you know, he got like knocked back hard. Like it was not a love tap.
No, it was not. And compounding the optics issue, reportedly, and apparently there is Facebook video, I have not seen it, he cursed out a fan in his home arena on the way out of the court.
Well, maybe that'll be his final moment in Phoenix. He certainly seems to be doing his best to get traded, although if he were smart, he would have just put his head down and played well. That's a lot more likely to get him traded than sitting around and pouting. A couple other notes on this game. Orlando Johnson on a 10-day out of the D League. He looks to have bulked up a little bit more athletic than I recalled seeing him in past years. He just had some moments, had some flashes, you know, playing some good D. He actually blocked a Sean Livingston turnaround jumper, which you almost never see that happen, and was able to just get out in transition, play hard, show a little bit of bounce, the kind of things that you want to show if you're that type of guy to have a team keep you around. And then also I decided, because in our continuing discussions about Steph Curry, it was getting a lot of tweets about, oh yeah, he's not even anywhere close to Wilt's numbers. For those who don't realize, back in like the 60s, 61, 62, the pace was incredibly fast back then. And like the league average shooting percentage was also like 40%. So they were basically playing about 125 possessions a game. Wilt played all 48 minutes. So if you took Steph Curry's season and he were playing 125 possessions a game like Wilt was in 61, 62, Steph would be averaging 53 points, 11.5 assists, and 9.4 rebounds per game, with a true shooting percentage that was almost 10 points higher than what Wilt's was.
Yeah, he's really incredible. And the other one, I've been doing this in the Warriors World columns I do, but he's already 7th all-time in made threes, and like for a season, and we're at the All-Star break. It's unbelievable.
Indiana and Charlotte. This was actually a great game for Charlotte, which was unfortunately marred by MKG's injury. Early on, he was really locking up Paul George, forcing him into a lot of tough mid-rangers. You know, I've made the comment that MKG doesn't have quite the great athleticism and length of some of the best stoppers on the wing, but he is very dogged. He will get into guys. Paul George is athletic, but doesn't have a ton of quickness. Isn't a guy who has like great moves. Is really going to just make you look bad off the dribble. And if he's coming off of screens, MKG is going to compete. He's going to get into you. Paul George likes to shoot over guys, being about 6'10". And MKG did a fantastic job on him. And one of our favorites, Miles Turner, was less impressive in this game, though.
He was minus 18. And I think the bigger structural issue to me with that is just that he's not a power forward. He's a center. And so I think he's going to struggle sometimes in those matchups.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. He is now starting alongside Jan Mahimi. And those are certainly their two best players in the front court. And theoretically it works because Miles can shoot jumpers a little bit. You know, he's probably as good of a shooter as most other power forwards, although he was off today. And he also can kind of, you would think, take a lot of power forwards down in the box, although he has a tendency to just settle for tough mid-rangers, which he's been making a lot, but I fear that, you know, some of that is a fluke. He's not going to continue to shoot 50% at mid-range like he has been for a stretch. But the bigger problem is, even when he's playing center on the second unit, he's going up against Kaminsky and Hawes. He was utterly unable to close out to the perimeter. He was getting blown by, giving up threes, not able to break down in a stance. And I'm sure that, you know, closeout drills are not exactly at the top of the list for a guy like him. Charlotte is a very difficult matchup with the shooting that they have. I mean, they play Marvin Williams, Hawes, Frank Kaminsky. All those guys can shoot the ball, put the ball on the floor with at least some idea what to do with it. And that was just not a good matchup for Turner at all. And then his pick and roll defense, he really struggled. He had some miscommunications with the guards where he thought that they're icing and the guard didn't do it, or the guard iced and he wasn't there. You saw that a lot of times. So definitely a step back for him. But, you know, he's a 19-year-old rookie, right? And that's why I talked about when I was the Pacers on the mock trade deadline podcast that maybe because he has a lot of potential, but he's not ready yet, taking a step back this year and trying to sort of shoot for being really good in like 2 years, because he's still, rookies just are not ready to play great NBA defense with a very, very few exceptions, and he, I don't think, is one of them despite his shot blocking prowess.
The big swing in this game was at the beginning of the second quarter. Charlotte went on a 17-4 run, which put them up 13. What do you think keyed that run?
Well, Paul George being out, for one, and then it was Turner being in against that Kaminsky-Hawes duo. Kaminsky had a nice stretch, missed a couple of threes, but kept firing and then hit a couple. And then Jeremy Lamb was unbelievable in this game. He was 7-for-8. I think he hit like 2 out of his 3 threes and was just absolutely on fire, hitting everything with the jumpers, getting to the basket with floaters. And when he shoots like that off the bench, it doesn't matter how bad his defense is if he's going to be that good. And, you know, Indiana without George on the floor, there are plenty of places to hide him. And Kaminsky not shooting very well on the year. You know, I think he's like 40% overall and like 32% on threes or something. But he does have a positive effect a lot of times because you do have to guard him out there. And then he can drive in and he's not going to get all the way to the rim, but he does force somebody to come over and help. And then he can make a little bit of a play, even if it's that kind of a glacial pace. But he'll just sort of keep the offense moving, let somebody else like Lamb drive off of a closeout, Jeremy Lin. And, you know, I think he definitely can be a positive player, even if it was probably a mistake to take him over some of the people who went after him, like Winslow and Turner.
Agreed on all counts. And I'm wondering with them, one of the most impressive things with Charlotte in terms of extending Lamb is that even if he's a sixth man, let's say, $8 million a year is a great salary for that in the coming cap.
No, that's right. I think he's even less than I think he's only 7. And so he's really, you know, maybe he's even a seventh man, but that still is pretty good. You know, maybe he can be kind of a Gerald Green type with a little bit more game off the dribble, maybe a little bit more defensive potential. There's still some hope maybe that he gets it, but in a lot of these games, he's just so bad that you understand why they didn't play him in OKC. But I think the failure to develop him is a little bit on them and obviously on him as well. But Clifford, I think, has done well spotting him, getting something out of him without playing him too much to where his defense is really going to be attacked. Because you're not going to, when someone's coming in the second unit, unless it's the playoffs, you're not going to say, all right, we're going to really go at this guy or design plays to make sure that, you know, we can catch this guy napping on the help side or something like that. You know, you can hide guys a lot better. Whereas if they're in the starting lineup, you're more likely to have starters going at you in a way that you're really going to get exposed.
You want to move on to the most surprisingly competitive game of the day?
Yeah, that was Orlando and San Antonio. Orlando had been awful, and then they won 2 in a row against Atlanta, and then really had a great game against San Antonio. They were up in the third quarter. They had a 11-0 run as it looked like San Antonio was just going to sort of inexorably pull away. They're up 50-40, and then Orlando scored the last 11 points of the second quarter to make it a game. And it was really, some of these Orlando guys look good, and they didn't miss a beat without Tobias Harris at all.
Which is a problem in a lot of ways. I mean, he's a good player in certain facets, but if you don't need him offensively, considering their surrounding talent, that says something about Tobias Harris.
Maybe so. I just think also the fit with him and Aaron Gordon and Vooch, I mean, those are really the three guys that they have the investments in terms of money or draft picks up front, the most logical starters from a talent perspective. It's just not that good. You know, Harris is not quite a good enough shooter to make up for the fact that Vooch and Gordon don't shoot threes at all. He doesn't really run that much pick and roll, and to the extent that he's a real good scorer, if you're playing him alongside Payton and Oladipo, who are the other guys that they're invested in, I think he's really kind of the most likely guy to go, the most expensive. Would you give up anything to get him, though? I mean, I think he's kind of, you know, properly paid at best.
Not on
with that $16 million a year.
Not on most teams. I could concoct a situation where a team strikes out so much in free agency that they're just talent starved. And so I like him more as a power forward, personally. Just offensively, I think his game works better there. You would need
I think you're right, but then he can't play with Vucevic.
Right. You would need a defensive center, and a lot of those teams already have guys who can do that. You know, like Utah doesn't need Tobias Harris or a player like that. But the Spurs, I think, so they cut into the lead, and then they started playing Rasul Butler.
Yeah, it was really weird. The Magic went up by 10 throughout most of really the end of the third, beginning of the fourth. They cut it to 6, and then Pop comes back under 6 minutes. Really the first time that I recall seeing a ton of this year, obviously I haven't watched all their games, of Kawhi at the 4, Rasul Butler getting his first minutes of the game. Orlando immediately kicks the lead back up to 10, and there's 5 minutes left. And I'm like, well, that didn't really work. You know, that you decided to, you know, take Rasual Butler out of mothballs. He's like 35 years old to play small all of a sudden. And the Magic were playing with Gordon at the 4. Fournier was at the 3. He was having a fantastic game. Hit a lot of step backs, even on Kawhi. Had his jumper working. Had a couple nice drives on Kawhi as well. And so it looked like they were just trying to match up. Duncan was just coming back. He probably wasn't going to close the game out. They had Aldridge at center. And Dia and West, I think, just didn't have the athleticism to keep up with Aaron Gordon. And then San Antonio got back into it with some great defense. They were switching everything. After some initial success getting the ball into Vucevic, they turned up the pressure, and Orlando just couldn't score at all. And then they just relied on Kawhi and LaMarcus to make great individual plays down the stretch.
And they also got the good fortune of a now Orlando trademark of a weird mistake, which was them totally messing up an inbound that somehow, like, they just missed Patty Mills, and Patty Mills stole the ball, and then that's what really swung it, because they still had a lead, and then that took away that advantage.
Yeah, Patty Mills, all the Spurs guards, Corey Joseph, you'll see him do this all the time too. They love to, their point guards, just deny the ball inbounds to the other team's point guard, you know, make you throw it into your two guard or your center and just kind of throw you off a little bit. And it's a really simple tactic that actually works way more than you think, especially in the regular season when teams are just kind of being lazy and like, hey, I just want to bring the ball up the court. You know, nobody's going to work hard to get open or throw it into one guy. And because you're denying him, now you can streak down the floor. Like, nobody's going to bother with that. And so they threw it into Vucevic, and he just, you know, sort of lost it out of bounds. There was that play. There were a couple of other little Orlando plays that really kind of killed them ultimately. And so LaMarcus hit a couple of real tough shots in the post, and then on Vucevic, and then they were down three, but they had an unbelievable inbounds play to tie it up with Fournier getting a wide open three in the corner on a baseline out of bounds with about 16 seconds left.
And there was a huge difference between that and the game tire that they, or the game, yeah, it was the game tire with Rodney Hood the night before, which we were watching, when Lyles held the ball around and they basically got lucky that they didn't foul. The way the Magic did it, it was a quick catch and shoot. You got a clean look, and there's no way to do the foul in case you wanted to in that situation.
Yeah, and there was about 16 seconds left, so it probably would have been a little relief for that. Anyway, unlike in the Sacramento-Philly game, which we'll get to a little bit, but this, it was really a sweet inbounds play. They, I think Kawhi was on Fournier originally. He got screened for, got the switch onto Green, and immediately upon getting the switch, streaked out to the corner and got a double screen from Gordon and Vucevic. Vucevic screened Green, and then Gordon's man, Rasual Butler, tried to help out, and Vucevic, quote-unquote, screened, really held instead Butler, and so it was just a wide-open corner three just right in front of the baseline out-of-bounds inbounder by Fournier, and he drained it, which set up heroics from Kawhi Leonard.
One note on that, you will never see that hold called, so while I disapprove of it on moral grounds, I mean, you kind of have to.
Yeah, I think maybe if you're down two, you don't do it, because you just have a better chance of getting the tie. But if you're down three, just do whatever you can to get wide open. I mean, your chances, I think Seth looked at this on Twitter, and basically your chances of making a tying three in the last like 20 seconds of the game, you know, with the shot clock off or whatever, are, you know, in like the mid to low 20% is about what teams shoot on those shots when you need a three. So you do whatever you can to get your guy open in that situation. I applaud him for doing that. But then Pop, he just went to the straight ISO with Kawhi Leonard. I've praised him in past years for actually running a real play, but he didn't have awesome isolation scorer Kawhi Leonard back then. And he put him right at the top where he couldn't really get doubled. Finally, the Magic put Aaron Gordon on him, and had been Fournier most of the game, which didn't make sense. They were hiding Gordon on Rasual Butler, which they obviously should have switched that, and Kawhi got a couple of buckets. But then Gordon actually switched onto him. Towards the end, he actually blocked one of his fadeaway jumpers, which you don't see very often. And Gordon got a great contest on Kawhi's, you know, about 20-footer, but he ran it down and just hit it right in his eye, and that was the game.
Yeah, that it was, you know, it was one of those plays. And what do you feel like, I think that they've been trying Aaron Gordon defending threes, and obviously it's worth doing at this point, but I feel like defensively he's going to end up being a four.
I think that's right, but he could be a guy who flips over and defends the other team's best wing scorer if they are trying to play small as well, and they just don't have enough shooting at the four. I mean, unless they're going to be playing Fry, who I don't think played at all in this game. I don't know if he was hurt or what, but it was Nicholson and even Dwayne Dedmon getting a few of the minutes at the backup big positions in this game. But Gordon can't really be defending threes unless you have someone who can then defend the other team's four, which, you know, with San Antonio going small, it was no problem. That's why it made so much sense for him to be on Kawhi, because Kawhi was also playing the four. So I don't know. I think they need to get a little bit more shooting, or they need to just, you know, get like Harrison Barnes, another guy who would be a fantastic fit on that team. And or maybe it's Fournier and Hezonja. I mean, those guys are 6'7", 6'8", and you could say, all right, we're just going to switch everything 2 through 4 if that's ultimately, and then Gordon at the four, if that's going to be sort of your approach, and you just hope that the ability to switch with everyone will make up for the fact that maybe you're sort of giving up a size advantage if Gordon isn't on the other team's power forward, or even if he is, he's, you know, not strong enough to deal with all of them, but you just rely on the quickness to make up for it.
And it'd help if they had a rim-protecting center.
Yes, it would. I mean, that's really, if, and we saw this kind of in the Boston Clippers game too, that if you're going to play like that, you need somebody who can play great pick and roll defense on the at the one position you're not switching, and then also protect the rim, which they don't really have, and Boston kind of does, but didn't play them up. But so yeah, let's get to that Boston Clippers game. That was an overtime classic. You watched this one more than I did. I only really saw about the last 5 minutes and then the overtime.
Yeah, it was a strange game for a lot of it, because they're two good teams that have a lot of kind of intermingling ties just because of Doc and Paul Pierce and all that. And early on, what struck me was that the Celtics start with two bigs. They start with Jared Sullinger and they start with Amir Johnson. And Doc decided to have DeAndre guard Sullinger instead of Amir, and it just led to Jared Sullinger getting unlimited jump shots because DeAndre wanted to protect the paint. That's what he feels his job is. And Sullinger's just like, okay, I don't care, and was just shooting shots. More of them were going in than weren't, and that helped create a little bit of an early buffer for the Celtics.
Yeah, Sullinger hasn't been amazing on jumpers this year, but obviously he was getting hot. He's a better pick-and-pop guy than Amir Johnson is, and it's kind of funny at the other end too, because Sullinger will always guard the center, and they'll always have Johnson guard whoever the four is. He supposedly didn't play very well in the early part of this game. That's what people were telling me when I asked. Like, yeah, I mean, I asked why you're having Amir Johnson out and Sullinger in, because they closed the game with their three guards, Smart, Bradley, and Thomas. And then they had Crowder at the four, and you think, all right, if we're going to play that small, like we were just talking about, you need to have your best pick-and-roll defender, rim protector out there. But that it was Sullinger instead, and the Clippers really were kind of getting whatever they wanted. It was really just heroic Celtics offense that enabled them to ultimately get, what, like a 139-136 or something was the final score?
Yeah, and one of the other
139-134.
One of the other components of this game, which I think is a larger issue that we'll talk about at some point, is that this teams that can play a stretch five, and we're seeing it more in the second units right now, really bring an element that certain teams cannot counter. And we saw that in this game when Olynyk was playing, because when they had Olynyk and Cole Aldridge out there, Cole Aldridge just didn't really have a place to be. You know, if you're the only rim protector, you want to be close to the rim, but you can't leave Kelly Olynyk open. And if you don't have a really logical other guy to hide him on, like the equivalent of a Tony Allen, you're just going to be in a hard spot. And so the Celtics were also able to get offense in those situations by just exploiting those kind of mismatches.
This is really almost a lucky win for the Celtics in a lot of ways, though. I mean, they were up 7 going into the OT, but the Clippers were up, and they got two really tough shots by Isaiah Thomas on switches down the stretch over DeAndre Jordan to get the game tied up. Marcus Smart had another heroic free throw offensive rebound that really helped them as well when they're at the foul line to get him another possession and get him back into it. And then DeAndre Jordan, although he shot a little bit better than his normal percentage, 9 out of 17, Jamal Crawford and Chris Paul, two 90% free throw shooters, they, and then Redick too, they missed 6 free throws between them, and that was pretty huge as well. So it was really, Redick was heroic. He had 27 points on 18 shooting possessions. Paul was unbelievable, 35 points and 13 assists. He was 13 out of 21 from the field, but Crawford was only 4 out of 17. That kind of dragged them down. Pierce didn't do anything. So it was really, and neither team could stop the other ultimately in this game, is what made it so exciting.
One of the hilarious dynamics, and you see this sometimes in the league, is that the Celtics' smallest guys tried to basically help out on DeAndre Jordan lobs And Marcus Smart actually, you know, he got called for a foul while he got ruthlessly dunked on by DeAndre. And there was another one with Isaiah where he just kind of backed up a little bit. And so you're just kind of sitting there going, well, to me, if you're going to do that, the way that you do that is to try to hit their hands, just because then you can try to get a foul and knock the ball out. But if he's already like a mile over your head, then just get out of the way at that point.
Yeah, I mean, Smart's an intense guy. He's going to go for it, much like Brandon Knight did when he got obliterated a couple of years ago. But that's one of the underrated downsides of playing small, is that your backside defender usually is a wing. He can contest that much better than some little guard is going to be able to. So if you're playing Smart at the three, if you have a great pick and roll threat like that, Smart is probably not big enough, even as intense and as athletic as he is, to really disrupt that. And then someone like Bradley or Thomas is at even more of a deficit.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Also, we'd be remiss in not talking about Isaiah Thomas's game. He had 36 points, got to the line 12 times. He was 11-12, shot 57% from the field as well. He had 11 assists, just unbelievable game from him. And then Sullinger, I mean, I wondered why he was in at the end. The fact that he was 10 out of 15 from the field and had 21 points and 11 rebounds and 7 assists might be a big part of that. I mean, I still think at the very least they should have been going offense, defense. But when you look at Amir Johnson with being 0 for 2, it kind of makes more sense. And that's why you should watch whole games instead of just the last 5 minutes, right?
That is true.
All right. What else we got to talk about here?
You want to do the Karl Towns show?
Yeah, I didn't see any of this. So I will take you through it. He had a career high, what was it, 35 points in this game? And, I mean, how is he getting his points? Who is he beating up for the Raptors? I would imagine Valanciunas was not the greatest of matchups for his jump shot.
He wasn't. And what's kind of incredible about it was his jumper wasn't great. It was good. You know, it wasn't one of those games where every one of his mid-rangers is falling. He had a couple of free throw line shots missed. He had one deep two that missed. He had another one that went in. But what struck me about this was how he scored in a lot of different ways. And that's something that, for a young big man, is remarkable. So he had, I think, two different plays. One was on Luis Scola. It was his first basket of the game, where he got the ball at the three-point line and just drove past him and got a finish. And that's what, when you think about Karl Towns as being a transformational center, that's the kind of thing you can do. His pass, the only assist he had in the game, was a drive-in kick, which is insane when you think about that as a center. And so he was scoring. He had a couple of putbacks, offensive rebounders. He had a floater in this game. It didn't look great. I still don't love floaters from seven-footers. And so the offensive part was there. And I don't know if you saw the very end of the game, but his block on Corey Joseph towards
the end. We're definitely going to get to that. I did see that. Yeah, that was awesome. He was only actually 1 out of 6 from mid-range, did not attempt a 3, but then was 11 out of 13 in the paint. And then he also was 11 out of 13 from the free throw line. I mean, that's the thing. Anyone who wants to compare him to Porzingis, he's just been so much more efficient than Porzingis has been this year. And probably even, you know, I think he has even a little bit more defensive potential than Porzingis. Maybe not as much of a pure shot blocker, but I like the way he moves his feet a little bit better on the perimeter, and also a guy who can hold up a little bit better in strength matchups. Ultimately, 4 offensive rebounds for Towns, the 3 blocks that you mentioned, really just an incredible performance of 35 points. And you know, rookies don't have games like that.
They don't. And something incredible about it, you said he was 11 of 13, you know, in the interior. His 2 misses turned into 4 points because Jang did tip dunks on both of them. So it's just like, you know, some days you're just charmed. And he was really spectacular. And his instincts defensively, I think, are what intrigued me so much. Like, I'm somebody who, as you know, kind of fetishizes the traditional 5 as being the defensive anchor. And I think the difference between him and Porzingis is I think that he has the mental part of that pretty close to, not pretty close to down, but he's far, far beyond what you would expect from a guy who's 20 years old.
So the Wolves started Zach LaVine at shooting guard. He played 37 minutes. All of these starters played 35 minutes or above. Wiggins was at small forward. It was a Dang Towns front court. Dang actually played 41 minutes in this game and also had a pretty nice game himself. He had 6 assists. His passing vision is something that's a little bit underrated. Do you have any different opinions on Towns and Dang playing together as a longer-term thing after watching this game?
Not really. I think that what you want with Towns, assuming he's the defensive anchor, I think he will be, is you want somebody who can stretch the floor and ideally create a little bit. Jang is a nice fill-in when they don't have Kevin Garnett. Bielitsa has been disappointing. You know, I think that he can fill that role, but you want somebody better, and my hope would be that you can use this time when Jang can look good, especially when the attention is going somewhere else, to flip him either to something like that or some other asset that you can use. But Jang has done very well. I give him a lot of credit. It's just that when you have a potentially game-changing talent like Towns, you have to swing for the fences with that. And what I kept on thinking about when I was watching this was, this is, in my opinion, this is the last year a healthy Karl Anthony Towns misses the All-Star game for a long time.
Yeah, maybe what you can say about Dang, if they can really continue to play together serviceably, it looks like they're going to be starting in the front court most of the rest of the year. KG has kind of been shut down with an injury. Bielitsa is, you know, really only capable of playing backup minutes, it seems like, at this point. But maybe what you can say is, all right, if we can get one more four on this team, presumably and hopefully a guy who can stretch the floor a little bit, then we can go with kind of a three big rotation with that guy, and then he can play alongside Towns or alongside Dang. You know, we could re-sign Dang and pay him like $10 million a year or something. Maybe that might not be realistic. He might get a bigger offer than that. But, you know, maybe for a guy who could be a third big that can switch between the two spots and play 25 minutes a game, $10 million a year is not crazy. Especially then if you have injuries, he can step in and start a pitch. And you could say, all right, you know, for 10 minutes a game, maybe we can play Towns and Dang together. You know, maybe that's a way that Dang could end up staying in Minnesota, because we've kind of been talking about it like, hey, they should trade him because you can't play those two guys together, and Towns is the future and you need to have more shooting around him as the featured scorer. Ultimately, we should get to that huge possession, though, that you talked about that Towns got the block on when Toronto was up by three.
Yeah.
Toronto was down by three. And there was, they had it with about 35 seconds left. So they had a chance. They're going for a 2-for-1 so they could score, play defense, and then come back with a chance to tie or win the game.
Yeah, so they're going for a 2-for-1. And what was remarkable about the block for me is that Joseph was clearly past him. Like, he'd gotten past Towns. And Towns, I don't even necessarily think he caught up to him. He just blocked past him. And Towns had done an earlier thing, I think it was in the third quarter, against Kyle Lowry. And he just snuffed out a Lowry drive when he'd gotten, quote-unquote, beat as well. And that's a pretty remarkable ability against those two guys.
Yeah, Towns is not incredibly explosive. He does have a pretty good standing reach at 9'3". You know, pretty good wingspan, but not like so unbelievable for a center. But a very underrated aspect of the ability to block shots is moving your feet to just get there to begin with. And that's what he is so good at. What really stuck out to me on that play, though, wasn't even that block, but that actually the Raptors ran a play to get DeMar DeRozan and ISO on the right side of the floor. He looked like he was going to get a good shot against Andrew Wiggins, and LaVine actually made a very nice defensive play. He came off of Corey Joseph and was able to stick his hand in, force a pass from DeRozan back to Joseph, and then he closed out at him enough that Joseph had to drive. He couldn't just take the three. Joseph also, on that play, was doing one of the things that really kills me. I can't stand when guards stand so far back that if they catch the ball where they're standing, they're not a threat to shoot. Like, if Joseph had been ready at the three-point line, and actually a good three-point shooter, which he's very hesitant, but he sort of just was standing there, not ready to shoot, not moving at all. And so when the ball came back to him, he caught the ball 4 feet behind the three-point line. He couldn't do anything, and that allowed LaVine to close out, and then he had to drive into traffic. The time to get the 2-for-1 had already elapsed by then. You know, so when you stand that far back, you're letting your guy help, and you're not in a position to make him pay if you get the ball. It's the worst of both worlds. And then he drove into traffic and got blocked, and that was pretty much the game. If they had been able to go faster, they could at least have played defense and then tried to come down and get a three, but that was obviated because it all took too long, and part of it was a really nice play by LaVine knowing when to help. Those are sort of the little NBA things that young players ultimately have to figure out. It was good to see at least on one crunch time play that he was able to do that.
Certainly, and it also gets into the idea of how, you know, defense and offense are a team effort, and so there were successes all over that play that helped it work.
Couple of quick hitters now. Let's get to Philly and Sacramento.
Oh, God.
The end of this game was not that great. Sacramento came back after being down by 15 and down by 8, really, even with about 5 minutes left in the game. They actually came to take a 5-point lead, and then Rudy Gay fouled Robert Covington, shooting a three with about 30 seconds left in the game. Then Sacramento was ultimately up three. They properly, George Karl, fouled with 9 seconds left to prevent Philly from getting a three off. And then I think it was Robert Covington who was taking the free throws. He misses the first one. So now you're down three with 9 seconds left, and they had no timeouts left. Why on earth he would try to make the second one, I have no idea. And then, of course, they inbound to Carlson. He makes two, and you're up four, and the game's over. If you have timeouts left, maybe you try to make the second one, but no, you have to just miss it, get the rebound on the free throw, and hope to get a three-pointer, which actually, if you actually do get the rebound, I think your chances of getting a three can be pretty good because it's a real scramble situation. You're not matched up at all with your own man nearly as well on a free throw offensive rebound as you would be on a normal possession. But whatever, he made it. That didn't make any sense. I do think that Brett Brown, while he has overall done a good job getting these guys to play hard, has a long, long way to go as an end-of-game coach. He really, I think, to me, has messed up a lot of these few games that they've actually been in this year at the end. And bears some responsibility, obviously, the players a lot more, for the fact that throughout most of the season until recently, they've just been horrible down the stretch, and they were in this game, too, to somehow have a 13-point swing in the last 5 minutes of the game is pretty miserable. But the other really interesting matchup in this game was DeMarcus Cousins against a guy in Jahlil Okafor who you might hope someday could turn into Cousins.
Yeah, I mean, that Cousins, would you say he's the kind of the high end of Jahlil, maybe the Jahlil ceiling in a lot of ways?
I think so. You know, it's really odd. I think that Ja is like has even a better touch around the rim, a little more skills than DeMarcus, certainly even that first year. And somehow, though, Jahlil is not as good of a rebounder, not even close, as Cousins, especially young Cousins. His rebounding is down a little bit this year. But then Jahlil, despite the fact that he uses his body pretty much, he never gets fouled somehow. Like he, and I think it's because he almost will knock the guy so far back, and then he doesn't really power through after that. He'll sort of like make contact, knock the guy back, and then just have enough room to sort of float up a shot. I mean, he had a couple of really impressive plays with his body where he had one play where he just bullied DeMarcus out of the way and dunked on him. Like, it was very impressive. I mean, you forget because he has these sort of like balletic post moves that Okafor is a really big, strong dude, and you're just going to get put in the goal by him if he really, is feeling like he wants to do that. If DeMarcus isn't strong enough to keep him out of there, I'm not sure who is. And Ja had some, was beating up DeMarcus pretty good. He couldn't stop DeMarcus on the other end, obviously, either. So it was a very interesting matchup, but just the biggest contrast between these guys, they're very kind of similar from a body composition standpoint, is just that DeMarcus is one of the biggest free throw guys, that we have had in the league for a long time, and Okafor, never gets fouled. But aside from that, they're pretty similar players, and it was good to see Okafor, what he was able to do with his strength, even to one of the strongest guys in the league.
Yeah, it was encouraging. From what I saw, there was a little bit less in this game of Okafor settling, which is another reason why his free throw rate, sometimes he just, if he gets the ball 15, 16 feet out, he's like, okay, I can make this shot. And that mentality is going to lead to you just not getting as many fouls if you're satisfied with that.
Yeah, he has this unbelievable touch, and he relies on that instead of saying, all right, I'm going to go through this guy and make sure, he's like, all right, I'm close enough. I know I'm going to be contested, but I don't need to go through this guy. I can just kind of, shoot a shot off the window. His passing was actually much better in this game. He had showed some flashes at Duke, hadn't really shown it all that much so far this year, but he had Stauskas out there with him. Robert Covington shot really well from three-point range in this game. He was able to set him up a couple of times as well. So Philly lost, but that's just fine. And for them, they get a few more lottery balls, although they can, of course, swap with the Kings if the Kings don't send their pick to the Bulls this year. And Sacramento gets to delude themselves that they're in this thing a little bit more. I mean, I guess that's the one thing we didn't talk about is this whole George Karl is imminently going to get fired, and then he has a meeting with Divots, and they decide not to fire him. You have any thoughts on that?
It's troublesome when every detail of what a franchise is thinking when you shouldn't. Whatever the reasoning for that is, whether it's a specific leak or whether it's multiple people, that's always a problem. And that's not a surprise with the Kings, but it's frustrating all the same.
The other thing that and this has been talked about a lot, Zach Lowe had a good podcast with Sam Amick talking about it, if you really want to get into this whole Sacramento thing. That was rather surreal because I think like they found out the news that Carl was actually staying on as they were in the middle of a podcast to discuss his imminent firing. But anyway, that's worth your listen if you're interested in that Kings situation. But to me, the most interesting aspect of this is the report that they wanted to move on from Carl. Then Divot says he's definitely the guy for us for now. And then there's a report that the minority owners weren't willing to sign off on firing him and paying his salary because that is something that would have required some more capital. And the minority owners are so sick of Vivek at this point that they don't want to do that. And you know, if the minority owners can't oust Vivek, they can get to the point where they try to make his life as difficult as possible. And this might be, well, maybe Carl should be fired or shouldn't be fired. You know, I mean, I think people kind of go both ways on that. But they can make Vivek's life difficult unless he's just going to say, hey, I'll pony up my own money to pay this coach. You know, we're not all going to share it among the ownership group. It's something that can be real paralyzing. We saw that with the big fight in Atlanta that really lasted years and years over the Joe Johnson contract that they initially gave out after trading for him from the Suns in 2005. That was like took a long time and probably was something that really paralyzed the Hawks for a while, and that maybe something like that is going to start being more of an issue with Sacramento. Even if there isn't litigation, you need your minority owners to be on board with stuff, and it seems like they certainly are not at this point.
It's a great point, and it again gets into how complicated ownership can be, and you know the stakes now are I think a lot higher than they used to be in terms of profit and loss and everything like that. And it's sad to a degree that a city that had to fight so hard to keep its team is going through this, but you know you don't wish it on anybody, but it does happen sometimes.
Yeah, and they're another team now with the optics. We talked about how you can't be bad. I mean they're going to get to the point now where pretty soon they should start tanking to keep that pick. Although there is a silver lining if it goes to the Bulls, in that they could potentially send their 2018 first rounder to the Sixers. That's the one that has the top 10 protection instead of 2019, which is totally unprotected the year after Cousins could potentially leave as a free agent. So at least you can start the clock. If it goes in 2017, then that Philly pick automatically goes in 2019, and you know for sure it's going to be unprotected. So that is one silver lining if they do send that pick to the Bulls. But really, they probably should just be trying to keep it and hopefully get better again this offseason. Well, of course, then they might have to swap it with the Sixers, too.
They're already there in terms of transition defense. I mean, their transition D in this game was some of the worst that I've seen in the NBA this year.
Yeah, even worse than the Lakers against them in that one early season
game. The Suns, kind of their nadir was another one in that conversation. But
yeah.
And the Sixers, it's kind of crazy to do that against the Sixers because they don't exactly have the personnel to exploit it, but giving them a ton of easy buckets is how they can win games like this.
Yeah, and they played at a pretty fast pace since Hinkie took over and now D'Antoni on the bench. I'm sure they're not going to stray from that too much. All right, let's spend a couple minutes on New Orleans, Utah, and then get out of here. Utah was exhausted after playing in Dallas last night. They really did not seem to have their legs. They don't have a ton of depth, especially at the wing positions like Hood. They're really, really reliant on Hood and Hayward to create offense. Derek Favors did it as much as he could, but I thought really the key matchup at the end of this game was Anthony Davis at center and Ryan Anderson going up against Gobert and Favors. And Davis and Anderson, along with Drew Holiday, excellent operation in the pick and roll, and whatever two other scrubs New Orleans had out there, were able to beat up on Gobert and Favors because Gobert had to guard AD, and he just wasn't quite able, especially with, you know, coming back from the MCL, his mobility isn't quite where it was yet. You know, he kind of still limps around the court a little bit. He wasn't quite able to close out on AD, and AD got some big hoops late that really enabled New Orleans to put this away.
It is astonishing how shallow the Pelicans are now.
Yeah, Tyreek is out for the year. Eric Gordon still has that hand injury that he is, you know, I don't know when he's supposed to be back from that, but probably not anytime soon, certainly not before the All-Star break, since it is pretty much upon us now. Who else are they missing right now?
Yeah, is Perk still hurt, or is Perk just not playing?
Well, I guess the point I was going to make is, at one point they had five guys who were non-replacement level. Now they're down to three. Everyone else on the team basically is just a replacement level dude. And that really hurts, especially with Drew still not playing a ton of minutes. They would probably be wise to throttle that back, both for his health and for their tanking purposes at this point, especially with now the way Portland and Utah have played New Orleans is dead to rights, and with Evans being out too, I think they can fully kiss goodbye any even pipe dreams that they had of the playoffs. A couple other small notes on this one, though. Chris Johnson, who probably I bet a lot of people listening to this podcast haven't even ever heard of. He's a guy who is, you know, probably like a fifth wing on the Jazz. They ultimately waived Elijah Millsap and kept him on the roster. This guy is probably like the greatest guy I've ever seen at getting back on defense. He sprints so hard. He foiled maybe like four fast breaks in the fourth quarter alone on like turnovers or missed layups or something that would have been an odd man situation just by sprinting back to get ahead of the ball handler. He would start the possession like four steps behind the ball handler and sprint back and actually get into the play and foil fast breaks. It was unbelievable. He had this chase down block that was absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, his defense is pretty impressive. Definitely leaves something to be desired from the shooting perspective, especially when he's out there with Neto. But just, I was so impressed with just that one little skill of his that I had to mention it as a guy that probably most people haven't ever heard.
That's great. And a reminder that these, every guy 1 to 15, these are NBA players. Well, I mean, just in the context of, you know, that
this just in.
Well, no, I mean that in a more specific way, which is that there are very few players in this league that are not capable of getting
in. You're not there for no reason.
Exactly, like you're that, and you know some of the, you know,
unless you're on the Pelican,
and that's important because when you're a team that's competing to make the playoffs, yes, the Jazz lost this game. You are going to need those players from time to time, and hopefully you don't need them every day. But Memphis is probably going to be dealing with the 14th and 15th guys on the roster. Portland has had all sorts of stuff that they've been going through at various moments. And so, you know, those guys matter.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The other thing I wanted to say on this, too, I tweeted out my observation that with Joel Neto, they weren't playing Hood that much in the fourth quarter, I think just because he was so tired after that monster performance yesterday. So it was Chris Johnson and Neto. Trey Burke was home with the flu. He didn't play in either of the last two games for Utah. And Alec Burks obviously is out. And so I noticed that, hey, there wasn't that much spacing. Drew Holiday was just not even guarding Chris Johnson a lot of the times. And someone tweeted back, hey, Neto is shooting 39% on threes. The spacing should be fine with him. Well, that definitely helps. But it's not only about just what you're shooting when you're open, because first of all, a small sample size, shooting 39% on threes, you know, out of what, 80 attempts, that doesn't mean anything. You know, if he had missed three or four, he'd be below average. So that's not enough of a sample size to say. But more importantly is just simply the fact that he doesn't shoot them unless he is wide, wide open. He has no versatility to a three-point shot. He's not shooting enough of a volume. And so really the deterrent effect of him making threes is not really there, even if he is going to make some of the few that he takes. So it still can be a problem, even if you are nominally a 39% three-point shooter. If the other team's scouting report doesn't say that you need to be guarded and you're not hitting enough of them to really make the other team pay for not guarding you, then it doesn't matter what percentage you're shooting.
Respect is important, and it's something Kevin Pelton's talked about before. There's a value to shooting sometimes, even if they don't go in.
Yeah, I think even his warp statistic has a component that adds in something simply for three-point attempts, because that has been shown to correlate with better offense, even if you're not necessarily making them. You know, there's just something in a guy's head that says, hey, if this guy's willing to shoot enough of these, we have to guard him. He must know something that I don't, because he makes them in practice. So something I better get out there. You know, I think that's something that applies a lot. All right, let's get out of here. Anything to plug?
There should be a new Real GM Radio tomorrow, but I'm not sure exactly when I'll have it edited, but it should be up.
Awesome, awesome. And again, we said this at the beginning, but if you have the habit of skipping intros, hopefully you don't have the habit of skipping the end of the podcast as well. Listen to that Mock Trade Deadline podcast with Kevin Pelton, Dan Feldman, and the two of us. Maybe my favorite podcast that we've ever done. We got like, I think, 10, 11 trades and basically discuss everyone that we could realistically see being moved and try to trade them even if we weren't able to. I think it should be a really nice primer for the deadline, kind of what the price is going to be for some of these players. And I really, really recommend that you listen to that. I also recommend that you follow us on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And also that you patronize our sponsors with that cap space code, SeatGeek, and of course, Helix Sleep is the other one. Talk to y'all next time.